Okay, welcome everybody to another iteration of our Nussbaum Family Medical Ethics and Halacha program, the last one for this academic year. I want to thank Shari Shemayim and the Bayit for partnering on this, as well as the Nussbaum Family for dedicating it. I also want to thank Barry Pegas for arranging our CME credit. If people could have their screens on, I always ask that because it really does help me in giving the class. I am not recording video, so you do not have to worry about the world watching you eat dinner. Just, you know, a few dozen of your closest friends, online here. I am, looking for topics for next year at this point. Barry set up the evaluation form to ask for topics for us to use for next year's series. God willing, there will be 5 classes next year, so ample opportunity to get your favorite topic in. I've been posting the link for the source sheet. I'm going to post it again now. If you want to have credit, CME credit for your participation, I do need you to write your name in the chat. You can send it to me privately. You can put it in for everybody to enjoy. You do not need to enter your email address unless you're not getting the emails. If you're not getting the emails, then I do need you to add your email address. Otherwise, I can't send you a certificate for your participation. Okay. The topic is compelling medical treatment. And this is something that people ask about quite a bit. You can see the agenda on the top of the source sheet. Medical care in North America emphasizes patient autonomy and informed consent to protect the patient as well as the medical professional, which we're going to talk about. Jewish medical ethics generally prioritizes the value of saving lives. And in certain situations, this includes overriding patient objections. How should a Jewish medical professional navigate the protocols established by College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario and the expectations of Jewish law? What happens when dealing with minors and adults who lack capacity? So that's the agenda, and I'm going to stick pretty close to that in terms of the issues that we're going to discuss. If you look at the source sheet, you'll see that I gave you some links right below the agenda. Someone sent me a message asking about new contact info. So my email address, torchino@torontotorah.com, should still work. torchino@gmail.com should still work. I have no idea what my phone number is going to be, but then again, no one's ever reached me by my phone number anyway. It's always by email, so it should be okay. So on the sheet, I gave you some links. The first link is for the evaluation. It's the same link I've been putting in the chat for the evaluation. It is very important that people fill out the evaluation form, both because I want to know how we're doing and because the accreditation requires that we get your evaluations. Below that, there's a link for the recordings of past medical sessions. I haven't yet updated that site to include the ones from this year, but it includes the ones from previous years. And certainly when you're thinking about which topics you'd like to see, check that list because, you know, people often suggest topics that actually, you know, have been done in the years that we've been doing this. Not that we can't revisit a topic, but it's good to know what we've already done. Below that are links for 5 classes that we've had over the years that relate pretty directly to what we're going to talk about. One on capacity for consent, a second one on the duty to follow medical advice, a third on issues in treating dementia, and you can see obviously how these are relevant. Another one on minors and medicine, and then one on patient autonomy. So all of those relate to the issue of compelling medical treatment. So what I'm planning on doing in our time this evening is to start out by presenting the problem, showing that a Jew is obligated to pursue life-saving medical care and that a medical professional is required to provide it. And on that basis, I would have said, in that case, you have to find some way to coerce, trick, otherwise get the patient to cooperate and to receive the treatment. It would seem that that would be a requirement. And then I want to ask the question with our first vignette, what do you do about the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, which would be extremely unhappy? And Jeff, I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest that that's probably true not just in Ontario, but even in the United States of America. Maybe especially in the United States of America, they might be very unhappy with a doctor who, let's say, forced an amputation on a patient. I think you'd end up at not just losing your license, but far worse. So how do we navigate that? Then we'll look at some particular cases, and you can glance at the vignettes. I'm not going to read them aloud yet, but we're going to talk about what happens where the treatment is not life-saving. What if it's just good treatment and important for somebody's health, but it's not a life and death situation. We'll talk as well about treatment that is for aesthetic purposes. It's to the benefit of the patient, but it's an aesthetic benefit with all the ramifications of that. And I gave the case where it's a minor and the parents want the minor to have this treatment, and the minor is saying absolutely not. And then the last case, the case of putting somebody into some form of an institution, a nursing home, a facility, where the patient is not able to provide consent. Those are the issues that I'd like to deal with. Each of these cases is a shaila. Each of them really is its own question for which one would have to consult a competent rabbinic authority in order to get an answer for a particular case. We are going to be bringing practical examples, but it's really, really important not to extrapolate from one example to another. The fact that we say something regarding one case does not mean that we would say it regarding every case. And even when the cases sound similar, it's very important to watch out for that. Are we clear so far? We're good? Okay. Then let's jump into the opening segment. The issue of compelling pikuach nefesh, life-saving medical care. So first of all, it's very clear. Medical professionals are required halachically to provide pikuach nefesh, medical care, life-saving medical care. How do we know that? We've discussed this in any number of sessions. I feel like you should be able to give this portion of it just as easily as I can. Probably to write up the source sheet also. So tell me, how do you know that there is a duty for a medical professional to provide life-saving care? Yeah. The Torah says in Parshas Kedoshim, if you take a look at source number one on the sheet, Minayin l'roes chaveru shutoveya banahar. How do you know if you see somebody who is drowning in a river, being dragged by a beast or attacked by bandits? How do you know that you're obligated to save this person? The Torah says, do not stand by the blood of your peer. When somebody's blood is being shed, you have a duty to intervene. That's the most basic. That is a prohibition against standing by. How about an active mitzvah, a commandment to intervene? Can anyone come up with a source for that? This one is less well known, but we have discussed it on occasion. So it's source number two on the sheet. I admire the integrity of people who looked at source number two and therefore said, I'm not going to speak up because I saw it in source number two. The Torah has a mitzvah of hashavas aveda, of restoring lost property. And we understand that restoring lost property doesn't just mean restoring property. It means restoring the person as well, restoring their own health as well. This may be seen in a medrash in source number two. The Torah's mitzvah of restoring the property appears in Devarim in the 22nd chapter. And the Torah says, Vahashevo so lo, you shall restore it to him. And the medrash in the Sifri in source number two picks up on the word Vahashevo so lo. It could be read as, you should restore himself to himself. And that's what the Medrash says. Afes atzmo atameshiv lo. You are restoring himself to himself. Now, in other words, when you return his object to him, you are returning himself to himself, but also there's an idea that you have a duty to restore people to themselves. If somebody is in danger, you have an obligation to intervene in order to restore themselves to themselves. That's a mitzvah aseh, that is a commandment. You could also add to the list, v'ahavta l'rayacha kamocha, right? Love your neighbor as yourself. That's a good catch-all for all sorts of mitzvahs. And so we say in source number 3, it's in the Shulchan Aruch, the Torah permitted a doctor to heal, and it is a mitzvah and part of saving lives. One who refrains is spilling blood. And even if the patient has somebody else to heal him, you still have such an obligation because one may not merit to be healed by everyone. Right? You don't know that this person would be healed by just anybody. So therefore, you have an obligation to make the effort in case you are the one who can heal this patient. So far it's very straightforward that you have a prohibition against turning away and a mitzvah of intervening. So far so good? Okay. To a certain extent, I know this is old hat for people, but it's sort of a step that you need to take along the way. What about from the patient side? How do we know that a patient is obligated to seek life-saving medical care? What's the basis for that?
That's Rapo Yerapeh.
So Rapo Yerapeh only says that there is license for a physician to heal. It doesn't say that the patient is obligated to be treated.
What about V'chai Bahem?
V'chai Bahem. So V'chai Bahem is a very interesting option. The sources tend not to quote V'chai Bahem in this regard. V'chai Bahem, for those who may not be familiar, is where we say that you have a mitzvah of living by the mitzvos. And therefore, one should not give up one's life in pursuit of mitzvos, other than particular cases. It is the source that is brought to teach that somebody who is in danger due to fasting on Yom Kippur is required to eat. As an example, we break Yom Kippur, we would break Shabbos in order to save somebody. I think the reason that V'chai Bahem does not get quoted as a source for the obligation to pursue medical care is because it's usually understood as a limitation on mitzvos as opposed to a standalone commandment. It's a statement of when you are fulfilling mitzvos, don't do so in a way that endangers your health. I think that's the way we usually look at it. Yes, Victor. Good. V'nishmartem ma'od l'nafsho seichem. The Torah says in Sefer Devarim, in Parshas Veschanan, you shall guard your lives well. Now, the truth of the matter is that in context, that doesn't seem to have anything to do with saving lives whatsoever. That seems to be to do with forgetting what happened at Har Sinai. Nonetheless, if you take a look at source number 4 in the Rambam, I'm reading out my English translations, but you can see the original Hebrew there. The Rambam writes in Hilchos Rotzeach Ushmiras HaNefesh, the laws of murderers and protecting life. He says there is a commandment to remove any stumbling block which endangers lives and to guard from it and to be very careful with this. And he quotes the Pasuk, guard yourself and guard your life. Hishamer lecha ushmor nafshecha. You should guard yourself and guard your life. That's not the same Pasuk as V'nishmartem, although it is in the same chapter. And he says if one doesn't remove it and one leaves dangerous stumbling blocks, he fails to fulfill a commandment and he violates do not place blood. Lo sasim damim beveisecha, which is a related verse, you shall not place blood in your house. That's in the context of the law of ma'akeh. The requirement that if there is in your house, on your roof, for example, a drop-off that is considered a dangerous drop-off, you have an obligation to fence it in. And you're guilty of shedding blood in the event that you don't do so and somebody gets hurt. So we understand that you have a requirement to guard your life. You can't have threats around in your home. You're supposed to make sure to take care of yourself. That's a basic prohibition. Here's a very interesting source that I had not seen, or if I had seen it, I forgot about it. But I rediscovered it when preparing this shiur from the Chazon Ish. Take a look at source number 5. The Chazon Ish in a letter says the following. One is obligated to try to heal himself, as he is obligated to try to heal others. This is the great mitzvah of Bikur Cholim. Meaning, the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim often gets translated as visiting the sick. But really, the concept is not simply to visit, but rather to look after the needs of the patient. It's actually to come to them and see what their needs are and be moved to act on the patient's needs. That's what Bikur Cholim actually means. And the Chazon Ish says, just like there is an obligation of looking after other people when they are sick, so too you have an obligation to look after yourself when you are sick. It reminds me of the Pele Yoetz. The Pele Yoetz, Rabbi Elazar Papo, talks about the mitzvah of chesed, of performing kindness for others. And he says, the first obligation of chesed is for yourself. Long before people were discussing self-care, the Pele Yoetz says, you have an obligation of chesed to yourself first. So too here, the Chazon Ish says, your obligation of Bikur Cholim begins with Bikur Cholim for yourself. And there's actually a story in the Maaseh Ish, which gives stories from the life of the Chazon Ish in volume 3, of how when he was sick, he said to somebody that he had failed personally in the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim. He said, it's my chisar and it's my deficiency that I didn't do it. So what we're saying here is that there is a mitzvah of v'nishmartem ma'od l'nafsho seichem, of guarding your lives well. There is a mitzvah of don't place blood in your household by having something dangerous there. There is a mitzvah of bikur cholim, of taking care of the ill, which includes oneself. And so self-injury is prohibited. The Gemara in Bava Kama says you are not allowed to injure yourself. And therefore, we have a very important halachic principle. In Aramaic, in the Gemara's language, it says, chamira sakanta me'isura. It means that danger is taken more seriously in Jewish law than prohibitions. It's worse to enter into a dangerous situation than it is to violate a prohibition. We take this very, very seriously, so that, and I see your hand, Ruchama, hang on 1 second. So that we say that if it's medically necessary to eat on Yom Kippur, that's what one should do. And that's that v'chai v'hem that was quoted before. And so, as we're going to discuss in the shiur, in the event that the doctor says you need this life-saving treatment, it would appear to be obligatory to follow that. Someone sent me a note in the chat about Rav Kook talking about early settlers exercising and playing sports on Shabbos from this. So the truth is, that was actually a very controversial line. It's in Orot. And it was taken by many to be code for developing military skills to be able to battle the British. When he said Lehit Amel, the question is, what exactly did he mean? Ruchama, you were going to say?
Yes. What about when it's written Abba le'orgecha, hashkev le'orgo?
So that's true. You could connect that. I mean, you can make arguments that that's not the same. But Ruchama points out that there is a halacha. If somebody comes to kill you, you're supposed to kill them first. I might have argued that that's different from medical care, because I might have argued if someone attacks you, it's more clear and simple to say, that's not God's will. God wants me to defend myself. But a person might have said, if I'm sick, that must be God's will, and therefore I'm not supposed to do anything about it. And what we're learning here is that that's not true. We don't say that. But that's what one might have been tempted to say, to make a distinction for that kind of case. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in source number 8, in a responsum that we're going to come back to in a little bit, but just showing you part of it now, not number 8, sorry, number 6, source number 6 on the sheet. He's talking about a patient who says, I don't want to follow the doctor's advice. The doctor is telling me this is required to save my life, and I'm not interested in pursuing it. So Rav Moshe says, if a patient's refusal is because he does not trust the doctors, then they must find a doctor he trusts, find somebody he'll listen to. If there is no such doctor, and the disease is such that we cannot wait for him to understand that this is for his own good, right? We've run out of the option of patience. That's not available to us. and we cannot send him to another hospital and doctors in another town to find somebody there who he'll agree with, then the doctors here must treat him against his will if all of the doctors in this hospital believe that this is the way to cure him. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein is not writing in, you know, the times of the Talmud. He's not writing in the 16th century. Rav Moshe Feinstein passed away in 1986. He lived, if not all of his life, most of his life, in an era when informed consent was the norm. We'll talk about why informed consent became the norm, but it was. And Rav Moshe is saying, we're going to need to compel him. So we have to talk about how you deal with that. But that's Rav Moshe's statement, and it's a product of the logic that we brought until now. Clear so far? Good? Okay. So we do have, as you just saw in Rav Moshe, quite a bit of modern halachic literature that seems to be in favor of forcing a patient to undergo pikuach nefesh treatment. One case, source number 7, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, who was in Toronto a few weeks ago, Harafua Kahalacha, says the following. For a patient who suffers from diabetic necrosis in his legs, so the tissue is deteriorating and you have to amputate, without any other fatal illnesses or severe complications from the diabetes. So in other words, the vision of the doctor is if we just cut out this tissue, the patient can be restored to a good level of function. The doctors must save his life by cutting off the necrotic portion, even if he resists the treatment. Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein in Shiurei Torah Lerofim discusses the idea of compelling a patient to have prostate surgery in order to prevent metastatic cancer. We see it regarding institutionalization as well. Take a look at source number 8, Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein, talking about somebody who, because of mental health issues, is considered to be a significant threat to themselves or to others. Source number 8. He says, when there is a great concern that due to irrationality, the irrational patient will endanger himself or others, one may and must hospitalize him against his will for his own benefit and to guard his life. He then goes into a key question, which is, in mental health issues, we very often have very little idea of exactly what the threat is. They may suffer from a condition that makes them irrational, but it's hard to say definitively they are a threat to their lives. We know that they're a threat. Sometimes you do know, but very often you can't really know. And certainly to suggest that they're a threat to others. So where is the threshold for institutionalization? So Rabbi Zilberstein offers the following. He says, I have heard from my father-in-law, Rabbi Yosef Shalom Elyashiv, that 5% is considered an uncommon risk, meaning, in the course of normal day-to-day life, we all put up with certain risks, and we don't take dramatic measures in order to eliminate them. It's when you get to an uncommon risk that you say, okay, now we have to act. So if there's a 5% likelihood, if you were to have this scenario 20 times, in one of them, this person would attempt to end their life or would attack somebody in a dangerous way. So he says, therefore, it appears that if the concern that the irrational person will harm himself or others is 5% or less, one should not hospitalize him against his will, according to the letter of the law. But if the concern is greater, one should hospitalize him. That's his argument. So we're pushing here for imposing medical care on somebody, and everybody can see the train coming down the tracks here of what are you going to do in a medical environment where this is absolutely not okay, in a legal environment where this is absolutely not okay. I mean, there is such a thing as an involuntary hold for somebody who is deemed a threat to others or to themselves. Barring that, it's very difficult to imagine a scenario in which Ontario, Canada, the U.S., any of them, would be okay with operating on a diabetic who is refusing the surgery, right? I mean, I think I'm correct on that, no? That's not hard. There is a view, which I'm not going to go into, because I felt like we wouldn't have time for the ins and outs of the discussion. Rabbi Dr. Steinberg has a nice discussion of the sources on this. There is a view that says that anytime you're talking about compelling somebody to undergo medical care, you require a Beit Din, a rabbinical court with expert ordained judges, the type of court that does not exist in our day. Anybody know why we would require such a court in order to do this? Why would you need a court like that in order to do this? So the basis for requiring a court like that is to suggest that what we're doing when we force somebody to undergo medical care is we're forcing them to fulfill their mitzvah. They have a mitzvah of guarding their lives. I am forcing them to fulfill their mitzvah. Therefore, I require a rabbinical court that has that kind of authority to force people to do mitzvot. That's not what our rabbinical courts have the power to do. On the other hand, you could make the argument that it's not about me forcing them to fulfill their mitzvah. I'm fulfilling my mitzvah. My mitzvah is to save his life. It's not about forcing them. You can make a variety of arguments, and there is a range of views on it. Like I said, I didn't want to go into it in depth. I just figured I would note the issue. But there is a problem when you're talking about surgery against somebody's will, because there is a halacha that says you're not allowed to injure other people. So by what right do you go wounding somebody with an act of surgery? Right? By what right do you injure somebody? So the argument could be made that the reason why you are allowed to injure somebody via the surgery is because it's davar she'eino miskaven. You are not intentionally doing so. Your goal is to save the person's life. Your goal is not to wound them. That's an argument that you could try to make. But it's a weak argument because there is here a psik reshe. The injury may be a guaranteed result of the procedure that you're carrying out. I gave you an example from source number 9, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, talking about providing medical care for a parent. One is not allowed to wound one's parent. It's even more serious than the issue of not wounding people in general. And in the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Moshe Isserles writes, in number 9, where no one else can do it, if you're talking about treating your parent, where no one else can do it, and one's father is in pain, the son should let blood and cut him as he permits. If the father allows it, you go ahead and do it, even though there's a guaranteed act of wounding. So why is this okay to do? So you could argue that it's a function of the Torah's mandate to heal. Mandating to heal includes mandating surgery. That could be. But I'll point you to an article by Rabbi J. David Bleicht, Palliation of Pain from Tradition in the year 2002, in which he says, because the pain that the patient is currently experiencing is itself a threat to life, and may be, therefore, you're justified in injuring him in order to get rid of that pain. I'm borrowing his point about pain and the danger of pain. Maybe you're saving the patient from that, as part of also saving the patient from whatever the disease is. So maybe you could make that point. Maybe that's an idea. But the bottom line is that as of now, it sounds like you're going to be obligated to treat this patient, even against the patient's will. I'm going to pause here. Questions, comments, thoughts? I can't really have talked for half an hour without raising a question. Yes, Robbie.
So one of the things that occurred to me is, well, going back to the original, one of the earlier cases, what if cutting off the necrotic tissue affects the quality of life for a patient,
mm.
and they say, if I don't have quality of life, I want to die. And with MAID now, so available, all they have to do is say, I want to die. That's a much trickier kind of thing.
Oh, I thought you were going one way, and now I think you're actually asking a better question. No, the first question I thought you were going to ask was just generally speaking, the patient's right to say, I want quality of life. But I heard within your question a second question of, what if you think you're saving the patient's life by doing this, but you could actually drive the patient to MAID? Is this lifnei-iver, essentially? You're putting a stumbling block in front of the blind because you could create a situation in which, thanks to your surgery, the patient asks somebody to kill them. Wow, that's a very interesting question, which I had not thought of at all. I think you would have to be concerned, although, you know, the question, of course, is always, you know, how could you know? You know, how certain can you be about where this patient is going to go with it? But I think that's very interesting. In terms of the first part of the question of, does the patient have the ability to assert quality of life? The answer is maybe. Because all good questions, the answer is maybe. So
they don't really have quality of life if they're dying with their, you know, with their necrotic foot.
Right. So a few things. First of all, a patient is entitled to reject a surgery if the doctors themselves acknowledge that the treatment is dangerous and or not likely or not very likely to succeed. So if you take a look at source number 11, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, take a look at source number 11. He says, it is logical to say that when most patients live, he is obligated to undergo the treatment. But if the odds are even, if it's 50-50, then it is logical to say we should not obligate the patient. If he is concerned for his definite short-term life, he says, you know I can live for another month this way. And he does not want to enter into possibly losing that life for the possibility of gaining more time. He certainly is licensed. The patient is entitled to say, this is dangerous, I don't want to go there. And that brings me to source number 12, which is more towards where Robbie was going. What if it's not only dangerous, but it's also painful, and we know it's not going to prolong life? Take a look at source number 12 from Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham in the Nishmas Avram. He says, a 50-year-old patient who suffers severely from diabetes, with harsh complications including blindness and circulatory problems and infections, whose leg was already amputated due to necrosis, parentheses gangrene, and he is now hospitalized with necrosis in the second leg, causing him great pain. In consultation with the internal medicine doctors and surgeons together, it was agreed that the patient will certainly die in a number of days if they do not cut off his second leg. But he is also likely to die from the surgery. And of course, even if the surgery succeeds and his temporary life is extended, this will not treat his underlying illness. This person is already in a very bad state. The patient himself refuses this surgery out of fear of the surgery itself and the pain and suffering of the surgery, and fundamentally because he does not want to live as a blind double amputee. I asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach the Torah view on this, and he ruled not to carry out such an operation against the patient's wishes, or even to try to convince him to agree to the surgery. Don't try to talk him into it, since this is a large and dangerous surgery which would only add to the patient's suffering without any chance at all of long-term survival. So when you get into the category of a treatment which is painful, a treatment which is dangerous, and it's not going to prolong life, then they stop short and say, not all life is equal. At that point, the quality of life argument comes into play. Ellen. You're going to have to unmute.
Sorry, it's Jeff.
Yeah, hi, Jeff.
Question. If a patient refuses a treatment that is curative and potentially good in favor of an unproven treatment, naturopathic, homeopathic, something like that, herbal,
where
do things stand in a situation like
that? Right. So we had a session a couple of years ago on the issue of alternative medicine. And I believe, if I remember correctly, what we said at the time was to divide it up into two different issues. One being the question of the permissibility of pursuing the alternative treatment, which is not board certified, which is not recommended by board certified people and so on. And the separate problem of neglecting the treatment that is being recommended by the board certified medical authorities. And what we said was, in the event that this other treatment is not considered dangerous, it's not considered helpful, but it's not considered dangerous, the patient is entitled to pursue it so long as it does not conflict with the regular medical treatment. However, the patient will, hang on one second, the patient will have an obligation to pursue the regular treatment as well.
So he can't, so saying that you won't pursue the regular treatment, which may be proven completely.
Right, would be a problem.
Or something which is totally unproven, it's nothing to do with certified, just as a lot of naturopathy and homeopathy medications that are given by certified physicians, that's not allowed.
Correct. The patient who has been diagnosed with cancer and says what they want to do is follow this diet that their friend saw written up somewhere and they're not interested in pursuing chemo, radiation, and sort of the standard approaches where it's treatable. I'm not talking about where the doctors are saying there's nothing we can do, but where it is, you know, treatable. So halacha would not look favorably on that approach. You want to do both, where it's not contraindicated, where it's not considered dangerous to do both, so you can do both. But that's one type of rejection, where the treatment is considered dangerous, and or, you know, very painful and not going to prolong life. A patient is also entitled to decline treatment where there's a genuine conflict among the medical authorities. Some say this is what you should do, and some say that is what you should do. And the this and the that are two different things. So I brought you the classic source on this, which is the Ramban. Ramban in Taras HaAdam, one of the first great medical halacha works that we have, says, we generally listen to those who are wise and expert. That's what we are looking for, is those who are wise and those who are expert. And he says in number 13, but here we listen to the wise, and the next wise, the next one in line, should not be asked in front of one who is greater in wisdom. He's as though he wasn't there. A little insulted maybe, but that's the way it goes. But where it is one versus two, since all of them are doctors knowing the craft, then the individual does not stand before the two. So if it's two versus one, granted that the one may be more wise, I would take two versus one, unless if he is much greater than them in wisdom, we are concerned for his words to be strict even against the majority, but to be lenient, we follow the individual. He says, it gets more complicated if the minority view is held by somebody who's clearly much greater than the rest. Then we're more apt to follow the one who's much greater than the rest, except for the purposes of leniency in matters of Jewish law. So in other words, the greatest one is clearly the greatest. He says you don't need to break Shabbos. The majority of experts, who are not as bright as he is, but the majority of experts say, no, you should break Shabbos and go to the hospital. The rule is break Shabbos and go to the hospital. That we will do. My point in bringing it is simply to show you that there is a possibility for a disagreement among the medical professionals, in which case we would generally say you follow the greatest among them. But we're not going to compel, and that's seen in source number 14. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, in his Mor Uktzia work on the tour, says, with an illness or a visible wound for which a doctor has certain knowledge and clear understanding, where the doctor knows what he's talking about, and he prescribes a tested, complete treatment, we certainly compel a recalcitrant patient if the alternative would be dangerous. He says, where the injury is clear, the doctors know exactly what they're dealing with, and the treatment is tested and everybody knows this works, then we're going to compel. But by implication, if that's not the case, then we're not going to compel. That's the point that Rabbi Yaakov Emden is making. Clear? Is that understood? Okay. So, where there's a conflict, we don't force the patient to pursue care. That's really important. Going back towards the issue of the quality of life and the patient who resists because of quality of life considerations. So this is something we've talked about a lot in our classes on end-of-life situations, and we just had one earlier this year. So I don't want to spend time on this in any real way. I just wanted to quickly summarize, and I brought you some sources, which I'm not going to read out, but they're there for you on the sheet. We have one view that says, in an end-of-life situation, you still have to do everything. Everything must be done to prolong life. Rabbi J. David Bleich, who I brought you in number 15, takes that view. The Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, took that view. Then you have another view, which says, no, you are allowed to decline. A person is allowed to decline care where the end is imminent and the treatment only prolongs pain. And that was the position of Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky, the stipler, in source number 16. I brought it to you there. Rav Yitzhak Zilberstein brought this as well. There's no obligation to undergo such painful things if he won't live an extended period of time. There's much debate in Jewish law as to what is an extended period of time. Is it 1 year? Is it 6 months? And so on. We've discussed it. I'm not reopening that. Some will require specifically food and oxygen and say those cannot be foregone. Those one would need to pursue. There are different views in that regard. And then you have the view that says that you're allowed to decline where the treatment prolongs pain, even if they will actually live longer. And that's the position of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein says one is allowed to resist treatment which will prolong pain, even if they will live longer, and I brought you Rav Moshe on that in source number 18. So there is such a view. There is another view, which we're going to see in a minute, which even allows a person to resist treatment where it isn't that painful, but I'm going to come to that. I'm not there yet. So what we've seen is that there may be grounds for resisting treatment, and we would not compel. Basically, where the pikuach nefesh status of the treatment is undermined. Undermined because the doctors debate whether it's effective. Undermined because the doctors acknowledge that the treatment is dangerous. Undermined because it's just prolonging suffering. So then we'll say, well, that's not really pikuach nefesh, and therefore you can't compel. Is that clear? Was that clear? I threw in a lot there and towards the end. Okay. But where it is pikuach nefesh, then indeed most authorities rule that the patient's personal preference is irrelevant. So what if you have a patient who says, I acknowledge that this is pikuach nefesh. However, I rely on God. I'm relying on God. I'm not interested in your treatments. I'm interested in divine healing. Is somebody allowed to make that statement? So the Chazon Ish, Rabbi Avram Yeshaya Karelitz, says, nope, that's not the way we go. If you're somebody who lives your entire life on emunah, on faith, you know, maybe there's a conversation. But that's not the way most people live their lives, and they can't start doing that when it comes to medical care. So take a look at source number 19. He says, for myself, this is a letter that he wrote, I consider natural efforts regarding health to be a mitzvah and duty, and like one of the duties to complete the human form which the blessed Creator stamped with the stamp of his world. This is a basic obligation. We have found that Amoraim, the sages from the Gemara, went to non-Jewish and heretical doctors to be healed. And many plants and living things and minerals were created for medicinal purposes. and the gates of wisdom were created and given to all to think and calculate and know. God gave us the ability to provide medical treatment, and that's what we do. And he says, granted that there is a way in God's ways to leap over the natural and certainly over most involvement in it. It's true, there is such a thing as the supernatural. But one must calculate closely, for both deviations from the precise path of truth are not straight. Trusting beyond the level of trust I have truly achieved, and trusting too much in human efforts. He says it's wrong to put all your faith in human beings, and it's wrong to put none of your faith in human beings. You're supposed to be pursuing a path which adopts both. So wrote the Chazon Ish. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, in source number 20, said the same. He says, almost the great majority of people do not merit healing via miracles from heaven. And the Torah itself says not to depend upon miracles. So this permission to pursue healing applies to patients as well. When the Torah says that doctors are permitted to heal, patients are permitted to pursue medical care. Further, it is a mitzvah and obligation since his life depends on it. I did see an interesting article in Techumen, volume 25 of Techumen, from Rabbi Naftali Bar Ilan and his brother, who's a doctor, in which they quoted a view from Rav Shlomo Gorin, in which Rav Gorin said, if you look at Ramban's writings on the Torah, as opposed to his medical writings in Torah Sa'adam, he seems to say that a person should not pursue medical care, that a person should rely on God and rely on prophets and so on. And Rav Gorin seems to say that that's a good thing to do, to say you're relying on God and I'm not relying on the doctors. It's not what we do as a matter of practical halacha, but it's very Rav Gorin. If you're familiar at all with Rav Gorin, the, you know, best known probably for being the rabbi at the Kotel in 1967, blowing the shofar, but also somebody who, you know, went to what he believed was Har Sinai to write a Torah. Like, yes, I could understand, I could see Rav Gorin saying, no, you could ignore the doctors and just rely on God. But that's not normative halacha. The patient who says, I reject your advice because I rely on God, God wants you to listen to the doctor. That's the general approach. What about if the patient says, I'm listening to what you're telling me, however, for myself, I want to fulfill this particular mitzvah that you're telling me to violate. So you're telling me I need to eat on Yom Kippur. I'm 80 years old and I have never missed a Yom Kippur since my bar mitzvah. How dare you tell me that now I'm supposed to eat on Yom Kippur? I can't do so. I won't do so. So the halacha is, the rule is, a patient is not allowed to make that statement. Not regarding Yom Kippur, not regarding Shabbos. If you take a look on your sheet in source number 21, I brought you the Mishnah Berurah, who says, if the patient is afraid that they're going to violate Shabbos for him, they should compel him and convince him, for this would be foolish piety. He should go along with it. He should go along with them violating Shabbos for him. In source number 22 in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, if a patient needs to eat and an expert doctor, Jewish or not Jewish, says that without eating his illness may worsen, he may be endangered, we feed him. Even if the patient denies needing it, we listen to the doctor. That is the rule. You can't resist that. There is a very interesting statement that goes against this. There was a great rabbi in the 19th century. His name was Rav Avram Bornstein, the Avne Nezer. And his last responsum in his volume of responsa on Choshen Mishpat is actually one from his father. His father was Rabbi Zev Nachum of Biala. And he actually argued against. He said, no, that's not so. On two bases. He was talking about a patient who has an internal illness. Because, go back to the source for medical care in the Torah. Right? What's the case where the Torah says that doctors are licensed to heal? What's the case where we say v'rapo yirapeh?
Damage damages.
With damages, correct. there are two parties, one of them hits the other and he injures the other, and the rule is that the assailant has to pay medical bills. So Ibn Ezra writes on that, that that's talking about an external wound. Ibn Ezra, keep in mind, is writing in 11th century Spain. So Ibn Ezra says, doctors know what they're doing when it comes to an external wound. He's not so confident in doctors talking about that which is inside the body. So on that basis of that Ibn Ezra, as well as on the basis of Ramban on the Torah, saying you rely on prophets, so take a look at what Rabbi Zev Nachum writes in source number 23. He says, still it appears that the righteous patient may certainly rely on Ibn Ezra and Ramban regarding prohibited foods for an internal illness. They want to feed him treif in order to cure his internal illness. So he's allowed to say, I don't want to rely on the doctors. They don't really know what's going on inside. They're not able to weigh in on a condition like that. And therefore I refuse. That's the position that he takes. This is not what we generally say as a matter of halacha. That article that I mentioned from Rabbi Naftali Bar Ilan in Tchum in volume 25 offers some justifications to explain why Rabbi Zev Nachum said it. I see a note in the chat. What about the patient who abuses himself? He drinks or smokes or whatever to the point his body is reacting, and the doctor treats him and tells him to quit, whatever, but he continues to abuse his body. What is the responsibility of the doctor? So the previous session that we had back in May was dealing with difficult patients. And there we said, in exactly this case, that you have to tough it out and find a way to treat the patient. Meaning we're not entitled, both under the rules of the CPSO and under the terms of halacha, we're not allowed to fire a patient for not listening to our advice. Where the patient poses a threat to other patients, we talked about. What if, you know, it's a pediatric practice and they're not getting their MMR vaccine and they want to be in your waiting room with the other patients? When the kid without the MMR vaccine is not feeling well, you know, so then we discuss, like, okay, so how do I navigate that? What do I do? But we don't have the right to fire a patient for not listening to the doctor's advice. So what we're saying here is, if it really is life-saving, the consensus is that this is the treatment and it's not going to prolong suffering, it's actually life-saving, then the fact that the patient says, well, I want to rely on God, or the fact that the patient says, I want to fulfill mitzvah X, this, you know, a particular halacha, we don't listen to what they have to say. If they resist because of the pain or the harm that comes with the treatment, we already said that, that it's possible for him to decline where he's already in misery and so on, like we talked about, and where you're not really going to be healing him, like the diabetic with the second amputation. But otherwise, we do try to get him to go along with the treatment. So far, so good. This is all preface. We haven't gotten to the vignettes yet, but this is all necessary in order to get where we're going. So, at this point, it sounds like the patient is out of luck in terms of making their own statement of what they want. However, there is a view that says it's not so. That if a patient wants not to be treated, and it's normal among human beings in general not to want that kind of treatment, the patient is indeed entitled to decline. There is such a view. This view is actually promoted, interestingly, in that article that I mentioned in volume 25 of Tchumen by Rabbi Naftali Bar Ilan. I find it hard to accept. I have to be frank with you. I find this view very, very hard to accept. I had never seen this before preparing for this shiur. I had never come across it. And I understand why, because I find it to be difficult to take seriously. I don't think anybody quotes this. But nonetheless, you're going to hear it. He makes the following argument. He says in source number 24, even though one should normally honor the patient's wishes, one should not honor a decision which emerges from a lack of rational thought. This is when it is visible that he acts in the way of irrationality and immaturity, or his desire is not in line with what people desire. This too is an example of an act of irrationality. In other words, what he says is, if a patient says, I want care, and most people would not want that kind of care, they're acting in an irrational way. They're like a shote, he says. And in his footnote, he quotes Urashi in the Gemara in Shabbos, who seems to say that acting in a way that people normally don't act is irrational. So number one, I disagree with what he's saying here, because I think that you can't really define incapacity that way. You can't really tell me that a person is not capable of consent just because their desires don't fit the norm. I mean, there's a range there. We had a class a couple of shiurim ago. We discussed shote, and it was very hard to qualify as a shote. It was very hard to qualify as irrational. Can you imagine? You have a patient who says, I want treatment X, and most people would not want treatment X. And now you'll say that for all, you know, halachic purposes, for monetary dealings, for marriage and divorce and all that, he's no longer qualified? Would you really say that? That's a very hard thing to say. I find that very difficult. A more reasonable approach, though, to say, yes, we listen to what the patient wants, is brought by Rav Herschel Schechter in source number 25, and we've discussed this before. I'm going to say it outside of the text, but you see in number 25 his conclusion in this regard. The position of Rav Schechter is as follows. The Torah says that you have to pay wages on time. That's what the Torah says. And it says you better do that because this person who works for you is putting his life on the line. Says the Gemara commenting on that, this person climbs a tree, he climbs a building, whatever he's doing that's endangering him in order to take care of your job. So asks Rav Schechter, I don't understand. How is he justified in doing that? Since when are you allowed to endanger your life for the sake of parnasa, for the sake of a living? And the answer is, certain dangers are considered normal. It's considered normal to engage in certain dangerous activities for the sake of making a living. It's not necessarily wise to go around climbing buildings. However, if you're a window washer or you're a construction worker, that's considered a normal way of making a living. So so Rav Schechter says, you are entitled to do things that risk your life for the sake of a particular benefit as long as it's within what normal people do. That we do have, not the idea of irrationality that Rabbi Naftali Bar Ilan brought, but simply saying Hashem gives a person the right to decline treatment if normal people would decline that treatment. So there is that possibility for a patient to say, I don't want to be coerced. I'm following the position of Rav Schechter. You can't force me to do it. So just again, to summarize what we've said, because we've said a lot in the last hour, and we're going to be getting to the vignettes, and everything relies on what we've said so far. We said there is an obligation for patients to seek life-saving care. There is an obligation for medical professionals to provide life-saving care. And on that basis, we talk about forcing a patient to have surgery. We talk about hospitalizing somebody who's a threat to their life or a threat to certainly to the lives of others. We do say that if this treatment is not truly life-saving, meaning that the treatment itself may be so dangerous or there's a debate among the medical professionals whether to apply it, maybe it's just prolonging suffering, then that's a different story. But if it really is pikuach nefesh, then most authorities rule the patient's personal preferences are irrelevant. Although I noted Rav Schechter's view that if normal people would decline something, then one would be able to decline it. That's the 1 minute summary. Are we good? Are we clear? Okay. So let's get to the practicalities then. Let's get to some actual issues. So if you can turn back to the first side of the sheet and vignette number one. Chaya, an experienced family physician, has a patient, Sarah, who has been diagnosed with breast cancer, which is advanced but treatable. Sarah saw her mother die of breast cancer and is scared of suffering the same fate. She initiates a MAID process, medical assistance in dying. Is Chaya halachically obligated to persuade Sarah to pursue treatment? What would you say? Speechless? 46 speechless doctors. And some of the screens have more than one doctor. Do you persuade the patient who has signed up for MAID not to? So I get a note in the chat saying yes, but compassionately. Ellen, what do you have?
I deal with these kind of cases all the time, and I actually had a very similar case, and I very kind of firmly and nicely convinced the patient to accept treatment, and I felt it was my halachic obligation, and the patient actually did, which was really nice. But I feel, based on what you said, that certainly we can't coerce, but we should certainly try very strongly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's a personal testimony regarding this. By the way, I'm going to note for anybody who joined late to make sure to sign in by putting your name in the chat. Having your name on your screen doesn't work because I'm not recording video. I need you to actually write your name in the chat in a direct message to me or to the world, either way. Okay, so I've got the note in the chat from somebody saying, it's public. So Dr. Glogauer says, yes, but compassionately. Ellen says, by personal experience, that you don't coerce, but you do persuade. So the ethical issue here is that halacha argues that you have to help the patient in this way, and the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario argues that the higher value is autonomy, and they have the value, and they have the option of punishing you for not taking their point of view. Here's the problem. I mean, there are a few issues here. The most basic thing is, you know, how exactly are you going to coerce them? Like, are you gonna, you know, get their spouse to hide the chemo drugs in their, in their food? Like, that's nonsense, I know. But like, you know, what exactly would coercion even look like? But there's a lot of fallout here. There's fallout for the patient. If the patient is not cooperating, you can have, I'm imagining in a surgery case, medical concerns that come with lack of cooperation, emotional health issues for the patient in the aftermath of a coerced surgery. I can only imagine what that looks like. If some of the family members got you to do this, the fallout within the family afterwards between the patient and the family members is very, very difficult. And then there's the legal issue, the requirement of informed consent. I noted for you on the sheet, we've discussed this before. Source number 26, informed consent originates as a doctrine in North America out of legal concerns. There was a fear of lawsuits. If the patient says yes, then you're covered. If the patient says no, I didn't do it because the patient didn't want it. So there's an issue of legal protection. And then there's also the idea which the College of Physicians and Surgeons puts out in source number 27, which says that respect for the autonomy and personal dignity of the patient is central to the provision of ethically sound patient care. So you're required to allow for that. Now, I see the note in the chat from Dr. Glogauer pointing out that informed consent is not all it's cracked up to be. Right? As she writes, the definition of autonomy depends upon the circumstances. Fear, complex grief, trauma from the mother's medical tragedy. And this is a big, big problem overall regarding the concept of informed consent. You have the patient who comes into the doctor's office not having any clue where things are going, and they go through their tests, and then suddenly the doctor sits them down and says, actually, we have a problem, and tells them something they're entirely not equipped to deal with. Or even where it's not something that's immediate and urgent and you have to make a decision now. It's over time. Still, they don't have the medical sophistication to really understand what's going on. You know, they have all the biases that come with their experiences, but they don't necessarily have the sophistication to understand what's going on. They don't have the ability to make that kind of assessment and judgment. They may be dealing with emotional baggage from elsewhere. So it's true that informed consent is not this simple, straightforward, ask the patient what they want, and they say yes or they say no, and that's it. Nonetheless, very often it seems like that's exactly the way the law treats it, to the point where trying to persuade the patient can actually get a doctor in trouble. You know, halachic authorities today talk about trying to persuade patients to pursue care. So as an example of that, take a look at source number 28, Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach. He says, logically, where a patient suffers from great pain and suffering, or even very strong emotional pain, I would think that we would be obligated to give him food and oxygen for breathing, even against his will. He wants food and oxygen. But we could refrain from treating with medicine that would cause suffering for the patient if the patient wished it. That's so right there, he's acknowledging the patient's ability to decline treatment where you're not extending the patient's life and the patient is in pain. That's his case. But if the patient fears heaven and his mind is not torn, he's in his mind, he's in possession of his faculties, it will be highly desirable to explain to him that one moment of repentance in this world is greater than all of the life of the next world. You should try to persuade the patient in such a case. Similarly, I brought you from Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg. If you take a look at source number 29, he says, one should try to convince the patient to agree to treatment and even to wait as much as is medically possible to let the patient take counsel or weigh it in his mind. One should wait for the patient to come around to the right decision. They talk about persuasion. They also talk about providing treatment without successful persuasion, as we already talked about, earlier. I bring you one example in Rav Moshe Feinstein in source number 30, where he says, yes, you should treat in a way that the patient isn't frightened. You don't want to frighten the patient because that could be bad for the patient, but otherwise, in that particular responsum, he's talking about a surgery. So the problem is that even just persuasion can get you in a lot of trouble. Take a look at source number 31, please, from the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, Advice to the Profession, Professional Obligations and Human Rights. They do this as a Q&A. So here's the Q. The policy says that, quote, this is the college's policy, physicians must not promote their own religious beliefs when interacting with patients or those seeking to become patients, nor attempt to convert them. What is meant by promoting religious beliefs? Does this mean that physicians can never discuss religious or spiritual beliefs with their patients? ? To which their answer is, no. The college recognizes that patients' spiritual and religious beliefs can play an important role in the decisions they make about healthcare and can offer comfort if patients are faced with difficult news about their health. It is appropriate for physicians to inquire about and or discuss patients' spiritual and religious beliefs when those are relevant to patient decision-making or where it will enable the physician to suggest supports and resources that may assist the patient. He says you can have a spiritual conversation. However, as noted in the policy, physicians must not attempt to convert patients to their own religion, imply the physician's religion is superior to the patient's beliefs, spiritual, secular, or religious, or otherwise make personal moral judgments about the patient's conduct that are based in the physician's religion. So, this creates a problem. What do you do? So, I'm going to give an overall note on this, which is, I believe a physician would be able to say, I need to keep my job rather than intervene if they genuinely thought that they were at risk. They could say, I opt for, how they're going to deal with this in terms of their own conscience is a separate issue, meaning this may bother them for years afterwards. But I believe they are able to do that. And here's my basis. When the Rambam talks about the mitzvah of making sure to not stand by well, the blood of somebody is shed. And take a look at source number 32. He says, even though there are no lashes for these prohibitions, inasmuch as they do not involve a deed, meaning somebody who violates this does not receive malchus, does not receive lashes, because they didn't do anything. The rule is that lashes are only brought for a violation that involves an action. If there's no action, then there are no lashes. So Rambam writes, there are no lashes, but don't think that that means this is a less serious prohibition. He says it's still severe. Anyone who destroys a Jewish life is as though he has destroyed the entire world, and so on. Why he throws in Jewish has to do with two different editions of the text that I'm not going into right now. But my point is that he acknowledges that there is no no lashes for this prohibition. And the reason I stress that is because of a point that Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg makes in source number 33. We have a general rule that in order to avoid violating a prohibition, one has to give all their money. You have to give up all your money rather than eat treif, rather than do something that is prohibited. However, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, says that's not going to apply to a prohibition where there is no deed involved in violating it. And therefore, the argument would go, you don't have to give up your job in order to avoid violating Lo Samot Al Dam Reyecha. This idea is brought elsewhere. Rabbi Ovadia, I believe, brings it regarding live organ donation, where we say the greater the threat to the donor, the less their obligation to intervene and save somebody's life. We saw when we discussed effective referral for MAID, we saw Rav Asher Weiss say that we need observant physicians, and therefore effective referral might well be permitted. So there is such an option to say, I can't endanger my parnassa, my livelihood, and my ability to function as a doctor in order to argue with this patient out of doing what they wanted to do, or out of declining treatment. That would be a key point for somebody who really felt that they couldn't convince because their practice would be in danger. Questions, comments, thoughts? Someone's just sent me a note in the chat about somebody who chose medical assistance in dying, and they had an observant doctor who questioned them, and the result was that they switched to a non-observant doctor. That was their way of dealing with it. It's a hard thing to do, you know, convincing somebody. It's not as though you just say to them, no, you shouldn't do that, and they say, oh, okay then. These are often people who have been thinking about this for years and have, you know, so bent themselves on it. I know of one particular case where somebody was just so committed to it that nobody could argue with them at all. It was a tragic case. Questions, comments, or do we go further? Okay, let's go further. So that's vignette number one. Again, I think from a halachic perspective, there really is an imperative of doing something about this. But on a practical level, one would not be required to give up their livelihood if it came down to that, and there were no other way to get the patient to change their mind. The second vignette is a more complicated one. What about cases that do not involve pikuach nefesh? They're not about saving a life. So I gave you the following case. David, an experienced orthopedic surgeon, meets with Yaakov, who is 60 years old and suffering from severe hip pain and loss of function. David believes hip replacement surgery is indicated, but Yaakov is very afraid of surgery. Is David halachically obligated to persuade Yaakov to have his hip replaced? Quality of life. And potentially this could affect health in other ways, I suppose, down the line. So Zev is shaking his head no. You're saying, no, you do not try to convince him. Am I reading your head shake correctly? Okay. Others? So, It's an interesting question. Even if autonomy does not overpower saving lives, maybe it overpowers general health considerations. So it is clear within halacha that people have a duty to preserve their own health, even when it's not a matter of pikuach nefesh, of saving lives. The Rambam writes in Hilchos Deos that you have to be healthy in order to serve God. We stay away from dangerous or bad activities. You're not allowed to injure yourself, we've already said. You're not supposed to eat things that are bad for your body. Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein points to a very interesting Gemara in source number 34. It's a Gemara in Nedarim that describes a particular very painful treatment involving an egg. This is somebody who has an internal injury. And the diagnostic involves what you see in source number 34. You take an egg, you boil it up in hot water 1,000 times. I don't know if this is literally someone standing there counting to 1,000 as you boil it. I have no idea. I hope not, but I don't know. You boil it up 1,000 times, you put it in cold water 1,000 times, and the result is that the egg shrivels up to a point where you're able to swallow it. If there's some kind of internal injury, then stuff from the injury, pus, whatever this is, I don't know, will stick to the egg. And when the egg emerges, the doctor will know what medication is necessary and how this, whatever it is inside, will be healed. I can't imagine what in the world this is, but that's the idea. I should look in the writings of Dr. Julius Preuss. Maybe he has something on this. Shmuel tested himself with this until his household pulled out their hair because of him. The pain that he was putting himself through with this egg. Remember, Shmuel was a doctor. So Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein quotes this Gemara, and he says that shows that you're supposed to undergo painful treatments in order to be healthy. He says that's why the Gemara tells us this horror story about the boiled and shrunken egg. It is clear that we have a duty to preserve our health, even when it's not a matter of life and death. Further, a medical professional has an obligation to heal in ways that go beyond simply saving lives, right? Whether you can apply v'lo samad al dam reyacha, don't stand by when someone's blood is shed, is questionable. But if you take a look at source number, no, I didn't bring it on there. Oh well. The Nishmas Avram, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avraham, points out that we had a mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, restoring lost property, and we said that that includes restoring somebody's health. So he says that will still apply, even if don't stand by while someone's blood is shed, does not apply. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg brought this in source number 35. He talked about a case in which you believe that your child should have certain dental care, and the child's refusing, and the child is already an adult. So Rabbi Waldenberg says, you still have a duty to try to convince him to accept treatment, not as your child and not as a minor, but because you're supposed to restore a person's health, and that includes healing the body. So therefore, there is an imperative for the medical professional to try to heal the patient, even where it's not about life and death. There is an imperative for the patient to try to pursue health. The question is, does that lead to coercion? So Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein says no. It does not lead to coercion. We would stop short of trying to really push somebody in that regard. Rabbi Zilberstein points to a Gemara that's found in source number 36, involving some involuntary medical care. We said that Shmuel was a doctor. So Shmuel and the sage Karna were sitting by the shore of Nahar Malka, a river, when they saw that the water was elevated, the water level rose, and it was murky. Shmuel told Karna, a great man is coming from the west. This was the sage Rav. And he has intestinal pain. The water is rising before him. Shmuel brought Rav to his home, fed him barley bread and cups of fish, and gave him beer to drink, and did not show him the washroom, so that he would develop shilshul. An involuntary treatment for Rav. Rav was very, very, very angry in this Gemara. I didn't bring you the full story. So Rabbi Zilberstein first said, if Rav is really, really angry, that means that it was wrong what Shmuel did. That Shmuel would have tried to heal him without his cooperation. Rabbi Zilberstein, though, suggests that maybe Shmuel is saying we heal people against their will. But then he backs down and he says, no, Shmuel's justification was that he knew Rav would agree with him in the end. That's why he did it. So don't prove from here to treat people against this will. Rabbi Zilberstein then asks whether we could apply the rule of v'nishmartem me'od l'nafsho seichem, that you should protect your lives, should we apply that to non-fatal illnesses? And he quotes Rav Elyashiv to say no, that something that isn't life-saving is a lesser form of v'nishmartem. And so he says there is no coercion for this lower level of need. That's the position of Rav Zilberstein. Rav Eliezer Waldenberg seems to distinguish between types of illnesses. He's dealing with an issue of vision, where somebody could lose their sight. And there he says, we do coerce. In a case of somebody who could lose their vision, he says we would coerce. What happens is he's talking about the Rambam on a Mishnah in Nedarim, where the Rambam says that even if you had vowed not to help somebody, you still would save them when you see that they are in danger. So wrote the Rambam. And Rabbi Waldenberg says this doesn't mean only life and death danger. It includes the risks, like a risk of losing one's sight. So there are those who argue that you would coerce if it's something really serious, like losing vision. But otherwise you would not. Clear? Is that somewhat clear? Normally we would not coerce for non life-saving care, but maybe for certain cases that are very, very harsh, then we would. When we discussed CPAP machines a few years ago, we noted the possibility that something that's not life and death now could develop into a life-threatening situation. That may be relevant in this discussion as well. What if it's not life-threatening now, but it could go there? Okay. Case number three, the case of a minor. So going back to the first side. Susan and Aaron have a 5-year-old son who has a large facial hemangioma, a strawberry, as an infant. The hemangioma cleared up. There is no threat to health, but the skin is marked where the hemangioma was, and Susan and Aaron would like to have laser treatment, which involves general anesthesia, to improve the skin's appearance. Their concern is for shidduch possibilities when their son is older. Their son does not want the treatment. May Susan and Aaron compel their son to undergo the treatment? That's the question. Can they force the son to undergo the treatment here? So I see a note in the chat someone sent me personally saying that there can be a real risk in overriding a patient's wish. That could have serious unforeseen risks sometimes in the treatment. That's for sure. I mentioned that before in terms of talking about the surgery and the complications that could come from a surgery that's against one's will. The dynamics afterwards and the emotional fallout for the patient. Like, you're 100% right. You have to be very, very careful about that sort of thing. And here we're talking about that for a minor. The ethical issue here is that it's only an aesthetic issue. But on the other hand, it's an aesthetic issue with potential very real fallout. We're also dealing with a minor who doesn't have the long-term perspective on where this could go. Right now, they are very afraid of surgery. But when they're 15 years old or 20 years old, they may be really angry. They've been bullied. They've dealt with whatever all along because this treatment wasn't done. So because it's already 8:26, I'm going to give an answer myself here. Seeing the note in the chat about whether they could choose to delay the surgery, theoretically it could happen, but my understanding is they try to do it when the patient is younger. That's my understanding. The dermatologist could speak to this better than I could. But in the beginning of the sheet, I gave you a link to my class on minors in medicine, where we talked about more broadly the issues with minors. Generally speaking, halachic authorities say one should make the decision on behalf of the minor. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg says that regarding orthodonture, and Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein says it regarding birthmark removal. Take a look at source number 38. He says, I put the question before my father-in-law, Rav Elyashiv, and he answered that one should carry out the treatment now, since it is a benefit for the child. Just the opposite, if they would not perform this treatment now, he would have a claim against his parents in the future if the marks would cause revulsion from his spouse. He seems to be assuming it has to be done now. Professor David Simpolinski also told that he asked Achilles Yaakov, the stipler, Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky, whether to carry out a cosmetic procedure for a baby who had an aesthetic defect in the eye, a surgery which would only correct external appearances. He ruled to perform the surgery, as it would benefit the child. Now, once the child grows up, the child has the ability to make the decision, and I brought you a couple of sources here discussing what the age of maturity is, but because it's 8:28, I'm not going to really go into that discussion right now. I'd rather give you at least a brief note regarding the last vignette. I can't stay late, unfortunately, because I have to get to Mincha Maariv. So, and my son has the car. So I'm going to just give you the last vignette. And that is institutionalization for dementia for the protection of the patient, where it's not an ideal approach because they didn't want to be institutionalized. And that's what you see in vignette number 4. So we recognize in halacha that it's bad to leave one's surroundings. The Maharam Rutenberg had a case in which, and I brought it for you on the sheet, there were two widows who had an agreement with each other, Rachel and Leah. Rachel paid Leah money for Leah to support her later living in Rachel's house. However, time comes, and Leah says, if Rachel wants me to take care of her, she has to move into my house. She goes back on the agreement. So the ruling is that Leah has no option like that. Rachel has a right to say, I want to be in my own house. And halachic authorities bring the case of Barzillai HaGiladi, who had helped out King David when he was on the run from his son. And King David wanted to reward him by having Barzillai come to Jerusalem and be supported by the royal table. And Barzillai said, I want to stay home. I'm already old. I just want to be in my normal surroundings. A person is entitled to say, I just want to be at home. However, in the event that the family is not able to handle the needs of the patient, then this may well be the best option. And I brought you source number 41, the story of Rav Asi arranging for others to take care of his mother when he was not able to do so anymore. And the Rambam writes in source number 42, if one's father or mother develops dementia, he should try to act according to their wishes until God has mercy upon them. And you understand the multiple meanings of God having mercy upon them. If he cannot bear it because they have become extremely irrational, he should leave and instruct others to manage them in the manner befitting them. In other words, arrange for somebody else to be able to take care of them. So says the Rambam. The Raiva disagrees. He says, no, who in the world is going to take care of them? The Raiva didn't understand the option of hiring people who are actually going to do it. He says, what do you mean someone else is going to do it? But the Shulchan Aruch sides with the Rambam. There's a lot to discuss in that regard. It's generally understood that this is not preferable. It's not what we want. However, if need be, if it's necessary, then one could. All right. Thank you very much. I'm sorry for not taking questions and comments at the end, but we are out of time. Thank you. Please make sure to fill out the evaluation form. That's very important for us. And send ideas for sessions for next year. I look forward to being in touch about it. Oh, and I should mention, my Beit Midrash is having a day of giving on Wednesday and Thursday. Please support the Beit Midrash, not just so that I can give these classes next year, but also so that the Beit Midrash can continue to serve the community. Thank you very, very much, everybody.